Welcome to another episode of Grace on Tap. Grace on Tap is a podcast dedicated to the history and the theology of the Lutheran Reformation, all over a nice cold beer. I'm Mike Yeagley.
And I am Evan Gertner.
So we're going to continue with Luther's postals. Then we're in the third Sunday of Advent. We're going to continue with that. We're in the Gospel.
Yeah, so we're in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 11. Last episode, we introduced the Gospel. It's Matthew 11, 2 through 10. I'll read it now for us again. Now, when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" Jesus answered them, "Go, tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. And the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who is not offended by me." And as they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds concerning John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? Behold, those who wear soft clothing are in kings' houses. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you.'"
So in the previous episodes, we covered up until Matthew, I think through Matthew 11:4, and now we are going to dive into Matthew 11:5, and this is, "The poor have the gospel preached to them." And it's interesting, Luther sort of sets this up, this portion, there's like this laundry list of the good works that Christ does, the lame walk, the blind see. And the last one is, "The poor have the gospel preached to them." And what Luther is saying is that that is the greatest of all of Christ's miracles, that you can have the gospel, the forgiveness of sins being preached. And when you think of all the work Christ had to do, it's one thing to make the natural order right again, bringing somebody's sight, let's say. It's another thing to bring the natural order right again, going back to original sin, where he goes and he fixes that. He fixes the foundational problem that mankind is struggling with.
And there you speak to that foundational problem. Our foundational problem isn't money. Our foundational problem is rooted in a sorrow of a sinner that looks to the world and is in crisis about what is going on. So Luther is going to spend time talking about what, quote, the poor are. And here he says it means nothing else to the poor than to have divine promise of grace and consolation in Christ and through Christ preached, offered, applied, so that whoever believes he has all of his sins forgiven, the law fulfilled, the conscience free, and at last life eternal is given. What more joyful news could a poor, sorrowful heart receive? So this is giving me a strong indication that Luther is not thinking about monetary standards between poverty and wealth.
And Luther makes that explicit in the following paragraph, paragraph 31, where he says, you know, is this only about the poor? Because Christ specifies the poor. And he says, no, of course not. If you look at like Matthew 11:5 or 16:15, what Luther is saying is that it's the spiritually poor that are going to be satisfied.
So he's not talking about the beggars or the bodily poor, but the spiritual poor. And so spiritual poverty, what does that look like? Well, visually, you can't always see it. People can be good at masquerading. You can have people that are good at wearing their face of makeup or their smile that feels forced. But the spiritual poor are those who are finding no consolation in this world.
And, you know, it's funny because Luther talks about the burden of riches, that when somebody has wealth, there is this temptation. This is in other writings, not in this one. when somebody has wealth, there's this temptation to rely on that wealth. When somebody has power, there's this temptation to rely on that power or to rely on your great learning or whatever it is that you've got. And what, you know, the trick here, according to Luther, is that we can be spiritually poor and hungry for Christ, even in the midst of all these great things, these great gifts that God might have for us.
So what do you rely on? Starts to show where you are in terms of poverty or rich. Those who have nothing to rely on and are feeling the weight of the world pushing them down, that's the poor. The rich are those who have something to rely on, but maybe not the right thing.
Right. So, and this is where Luther, and it's one of his favorite things to get into, is works righteousness. And he said, the next paragraph, he dives into works righteousness. And he says, hey, you could have no money at all. You could be, you know, you could be a monk living in poverty, but where you are spiritually rich, where you are relying on your good works. And that means that you are rejecting the gospel, which is the you know, it's sort of like an upside down world for what Luther's day was.
Yeah, the language sounds upside down. The rich are the ones who are in greatest danger and the greatest enemies of the gospel. So you see, the greatest enemies of the gospel are, namely, the works righteous saints who are overconfident. For the gospel cannot at all agree with such people. They want to be rich in works, but the gospel wants them to be poor. If they will not yield, the gospel also cannot yield. The imperishable word of God is going to penetrate to any sort of idol factory we produce. And as we produce these idols, and as we produce more and more idols, we can get very rich in our statue of idols. Here, I'm not talking about things made of stone or wood, as you may think of like something you'd find in a museum where they have the idols of some ancient culture. But we can get rich in our works, rich in our standards, and rich in the shields we've built around ourselves to give ourselves ease and comfort.
Yeah, it's you know, when we rely on anything except for the good news given to us by Christ, it's that reliance. And when you build up something and you rely on it, and what you can rely on is something like your good works, or you can rely on the perception of others of you, or you can rely on your wealth. You know, there are plenty of people who do that. It doesn't matter. It's what you rely on that's the idolatry that Luther is coming out against. And so he starts getting into this, and he starts talking about how whatever it is that you might have picked, and we'll use works righteousness, because that's where Luther uses in this particular writing. He dives into the works righteous side, and he says, okay, you have got these two millstones, and he uses this visualization of two millstones, which is going back to something that the people of that era would have been very familiar with. We're not so familiar with it, and so maybe we should talk a little bit about what
a millstone, heavy, heavy piece of stone, put on top of another heavy piece of stone. Between those two pieces of stone, you would have your germ of wheat, you'd grind, having those two pieces of stone grind and grind and grind, and you'd end up with flour. So the stones are incredibly heavy. To have a millstone, to fall on you would crush you.
Right. So Luther says that those who are relying on good works are caught between two millstones. There's the millstone of truth, of Christ's promise, of the freedom of the gospel, of not having that works righteous, of relying on Christ alone. And then on the top millstone is your desire for works righteousness.
And this glory you find in your works.
And you get crushed between the two. Is that what Luther is saying? Is that when you are going to rely on that, on those good works, you end up, because the gospel is solid. That's rock solid.
Immovable, quiet, peaceful, and the upper stone with its works and those masters that rage in their strength. And they rant against the gospel, pushing a lot of people right now during this time of the Reformation. And he's trying to say that this bottom stone is not going to move. That top stone that's doing all this crushing, it's got to give way.
Yeah. Yeah, and so you have this visualization that Luther sets up to help his listeners understand just how damaging all of this is, how damaging this works righteousness is, and how, like Evan said, and like Luther says, how immovable and peaceful that bottom stone is, how immovable and peaceful the gospel is. It's not giving, and you can crush yourself against it all you want, but the gospel is still going to be there proclaiming, you don't need to do this.
And the rich that are richer in their glories, rich in their works, they are at ease in this world, and they're celebrated in this world, and they are triumphed and trumpeted in this world. But Jesus says, go back and tell John that the poor are having good news preached to them. And with all of this, there's something contradicting fleshly, worldly opinion that people may have about Christ's coming, that those who have been doing works and those who have been looking righteous in this world are all gathered together, and you get like this all-star team of workers. And instead of Jesus going and developing that all-star team, he goes to the poor, those who are broken and wearied by the crushing age that we are in, and he tells them, there is a good news for you.
Yeah, it's interesting because, we have this era. We live in an era of what is commonly called antinomianism, right? And we've talked about this before.
Against the law, that there isn't a law, that you can do whatever you want.
Right. But the fact is that it doesn't matter if you try to get rid of God's law, then people are going to create their own law. There is always going to be this desire for the law. And so you end up with, no matter what you do, you're going to be chasing the law. And in a way, Luther's words are just as valid today as they were back then. We don't think this is a works righteous era, but in many ways it is. We just have a different set of works that we're trying to hang our hats on.
We all live in positions where worldly glory or a sense of success and achievement is necessary for the office that we hold. And as we start to see others give us acclaim and those words that give us a sense that we are standing somewhere strong, that worldly glory, it's attractive.
It is very attractive. And if I said I wasn't attracted to it, I'd be a liar. It is hard when you find yourself in a position and you see people who are moving up ahead of you and they don't seem as competent as you think they should, blah, 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 blah. There's all sorts of ways you can, that we set up our own systems that we try to press into this world. We have this vision of the way the world should be, and the world just doesn't comply.
But we try to move up that ladder. And now here's something I think that has taken me some time to figure out. But those people who are higher up on the ladder that I am envious of, the law is also working on them.
Oh, yeah.
And their narrative loop that's going on in their head is filled with crisis too, that no matter where you are at in the ladder of worldly glories, there is always this crisis and crushing of the law that's going to hit on you, that's going to bear on you. And it arrives at different moments, but that moment when we go, I need the good news. And it's never fair to say, well, they don't need the good news because they've got it all figured out. They've got the worldly glory that their office requires and everything's fine for them. I would be cautious about judging them and placing them into that spot of no longer needing Jesus because they're going to need him too.
Going back, and exactly, and just to tie this back to Luther in paragraph 34, he's talking about exactly this. He's talking about how the apostles, how the disciples, how the people of that era, the followers of John, all these people were looking for somebody who was going to be glorious, somebody that was going to be powerful, a new David, a new Davidic kingdom. And Christ is saying, no, that's not how I'm coming. That's not the glory. That's not worldly glory that we're doing here.
He said that would even be a disgrace to me because it would seem that I needed them. He needed those people that were lifting him up and praising him and trumpeting him and carrying him home. It would be a disgrace that I needed them and was benefited by them as worldly rulers are by their subjects. I must do otherwise and keep to those who can be benefited by me. I must associate with the blind, the lame, the dumb, and all those kind of sick people. That character and nature of my kingdom demands this. Christ comes to serve, not to be served.
Just a final point on that is as we make the mistake of chasing worldly glory, what we just think about what Luther just said, what we're doing is we're giving ourselves over to be dependent on others. You know, we're giving ourselves over to be dependent on their view of us.
I need those likes. I need those hearts to show up. I need those emojis. I send you a text. I need right away that acclaim and that trumpet from you that lets me know I'm good.
Yeah, and that's all a rebuke of the gospel. That's all, you know, we rebuke the gospel every day. You know, at least I do. I don't know. I'm not going to speak for Evan, but I fall into that where I am not fully dependent on the gospel. And that's something that is a constant challenge that I try to grow into.
Luther says, consider this. Those who are sound, rich, strong, pure, alive, godly, and able in every respect, to such as those, Jesus is of no benefit, and they obtain nothing from Jesus. They would even be a disgrace to him. It's a remarkable thing to look at what this word poverty means. But we are not in poverty of beer. So we've got Founders All Night IPA. It's a session black IPA. This is
It's almost like a stout.
It is dark. It's got that bitterness. It doesn't have the fruity orange notes that it says it should. I don't think. So this is what Founders says about itself. A perfect counterpart of our all-day IPA, meet all-night IPA. All-night IPA joins the ranks of the all-day series with its chocolatey sweet aromatics that blend with pine and orange hop notes. I didn't taste the orange.
I didn't taste the orange either, but it's...
The pine I taste.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's got more kick to it than a typical stout. It looks like a stout coming out of the can. It's very dark.
Yeah. It gets the all-day series from Founders are all under 5%.
And so, is that what that's about?
So they're trying to create a beer that's got lots of flavor and hits at some of those more particular brews, but you could drink it. They're saying
all day. I don't know. It's 4.9%. I don't think that's all
it's,
day
it's,
for
it's
me.
Not near beer. It's real beer.
It's real beer.
It's real beer. So what do you think? Chocolatey?
Very chocolatey.
Sweet?
No, I don't taste.
No.
It's the bitterness of when I took the drink of it, it really lit up the back bitter taste bud. There's that taste bud in the back corner of your tongue, mm-hmm. that just like, wow, there's bitter for you. Yeah.
Now, Founders Hope is... An all-night is a, I mean, this all-day IPA series, this all-night IPA, this whole series is one that you would buy a 12-pack up and enjoy the whole 12-pack. I couldn't enjoy more than one of these.
No. This is, it's supposed to be a winter beer.
They sell it August through December.
Yeah, and so it's supposed to be for winter. When cold, those cold, dark nights, you know, is what it's about. Okay, you know, it's more bitter than than I was expecting for an IPA.
Mm-hmm.
I think not more bitter. It's more. It doesn't have like you said, not that fruitiness. I guess I've gotten sort of spoiled in the time we've been doing these podcasts. I really do like those citrus IPAs.
Yeah, so a New England IPA that we got to feature from Eastern Market is a good example.
Yeah, that was good. This is more, like I said, it's sort of like a, so to me, it's almost like a mix between a stout and an IPA, but It's good.
Are you offended by it?
No.
All right. So this is a good transition into the next verse that Jesus says, "Blessed is the one who is not offended by me." And Luther's going to go on and talk about two kinds of offenses or two kinds of sins that we will see and experience in this world. And so one is going to be the doctrine, where there is an you get good doctrine, bad doctrine. Bad doctrine, that's offensive. And bad doctrine, people are offended by the good doctrine of Christ. And then you have the offense of public and open sin.
Right. And so, and when Luther looks at this, those who are offended by me, he's looking at it like that those who are offended by good doctrine, you know, is what he's really looking at, where you just can't stand the gospel. It's just, it's offensive. It's offensive that my works don't matter. It's offensive that, you know, especially in this era, you know, what? My fasting every Friday doesn't add up to anything?
My prayer six times a day doesn't mean something? Yeah, that offensive doctrine in life. And Luther says Scripture most often deals with the offense of bad doctrine, looking at Christ and Paul, scarcely mentioning the offense of life.
So when Luther talks about the offense of life, we can quickly cover that because he covers it pretty quickly. The offense of life, this is Luther writing, the offense of a life is when one sees an openly wicked work done by another and teaches it. But it is impossible to avoid this offense since we have to live among the wicked. So what Luther is saying is, as we are tempted away from, you know, from reliance on God. This is, I guess I always look at this, I always come back to that reliance on God. When we see somebody doing something evil or wicked or whatever, and we're tempted to teach it, it's because we think there's something good there. We think that there's something fun there or happy or whatever. And we give up on our reliance on God. We chase after this thing that, let's say, use an example, you know, making a lot of money, right? And let's say it's something like that. And somebody's talking about how much they love their money and it's in their stock portfolio, whatever. And we chase after that. And we teach it. And we teach reliance on that.
And we measure people naturally somewhat by life.
Yeah.
But Luther's going to keep directing us to look more seriously at the concerns that can happen when there's a scandal in doctrine. Because he said a scandal in doctrine will lead to rejecting Christ and destroying faith.
Yeah, it's sort of like I guess I look at it, and maybe Evan, you can comment on this, but I look at it like the offense of life is a symptom of the disease of an offense of doctrine. You know, if you fall into, you know, worrying about the things of life, you're long past, you know, you've bought into an offensive doctrine. You've given up on the doctrine according to the gospel.
So as we think about life and wickedness, one of the ways I sometimes will describe this is with the word sin, capital letter sin, and lowercase sin, plural. So you got sin, big capital letters, skywriting sin. That's the one we really got to notice. That's the broken relationship with God. That's something that leads to broken relationship with people, unresolved. Then you got the lowercase s, but it's plural, sins. Those are the wicked things that people do. And we could like play whack-a-mole with sins. But if we never deal with the issue of the big capital, huge letter sin, then all we're doing is knocking one thing and it finds up and pops up another way.
You know, you look at Christ's ministry, and it's sort of a mirror of that. It's because, you know, in his era, everybody expected the Messiah. Everybody expected the Christ to come in and establish a new political kingdom and was going to fix everything for them.
Deal with all those wicked works they see.
All the small s stuff that's out there. You know, we're all done with that. We want to live in a better world. And Christ said, no. I'm not going to play whack-a-mole with that. I'm not going to chase after every little thing that goes wrong. No, I'm going after the big sin. I'm going after the big sin.
So this is how Luther describes this. He says, therefore, to undertake reform of the Pope, the monasteries, and the universities, and still maintain them in their essence and character would be like squeezing water out of snow and still trying to preserve the snow. But what it means is to preach Christ among the blind and the poor. That's how we could see an end. So then what happens after Jesus does this? 7-9. As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds concerning John. What did you go out into the wilderness to see? Did you go out to see a reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Did you want to see a man in soft clothing? Behold, those who wear soft clothing are in king's houses. What then did you go out to see? Did you want to see a prophet? Yes, I tell you, he's more than a prophet. And here's where our text is going to take a transition. And we have this opportunity in this transition that we'll be looking at is what are people looking for? As people come back and they talk about John, or as people are looking at Jesus and they're trying to figure out, do we look for Jesus? Do we keep looking for Jesus? Are we just looking for that reed that gets shaken? And it tells us there's a wind blowing somewhere. Are we just looking for another person that arrives in soft clothing and ease and comfort and tells us what to do? No, we were always looking for John because he was bringing an axe to a rotten tree. He was wearing the weird locust wild honey that showed us that he's in the wilderness. And hey, wait a minute, we're in the wilderness too. So Jesus is saying, remember why you saw John? That's why you need to be seeing me as well.
Right.
So here we are. We've got a time of transition in our text.
Yeah, I think we're going to call this one short. We'll cut this one a little bit short. And then we're going to pick up again and finish off, hopefully finish off. We've almost got too much to cover in one episode and not enough for two. So we're going to have probably two shorter episodes, and then we'll pick up again after that.
So this has been Grace on Tap, Evan Gertner,
Mike Yeagley. If you have anything that you would like us to cover, we really do appreciate any emails, any texts, any messages on Facebook. We love hearing from you. What you'd like us to get into. You know, we've spent quite a bit of time on the postals. Have to say, I personally love the postals. So we could keep doing this, or we could start looking into other things. And so if you have any suggestions, please shoot us a note and let us know. Prost.
Prost.